Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman of uncommon intelligence who has brought it to bear, thanks be to God, for all of us for a long time, in her role as one of the founders and leaders of the Tea Party Patriots, is an old friend of mine by the name of Jenny Beth Martin. She is an extraordinary force for good, a freedom fighter on a whole host of issues, and we wanted to have her with us to talk a bit about a particularly problematic piece of legislation we've touched on now a number of times in recent days, but that is hurtling down the tracks at us, known by its bill number H.R. 1, reflecting the priority that Nancy Pelosi's House of Representatives is giving it, and a similar priority, S-1, in the Senate under Chuck Schumer. Its formal name is the For the People Act. It seems to have very little to do with the people, at least the little people, the people like us. Jenny Beth Martin, thank you so much for all that you do, but also in particular your leadership on this legislative fight. It's deeply appreciated. Tell us about H.R. 1 and why it's needed to fight it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Frank, and for such a kind introduction. H.R. 1 is a bill that is horrible on so many fronts. It is going to make it impossible to verify that the people who vote in elections are actually legally able to vote in a particular precinct where they're voting. So in the last election cycle, we said we need to make sure we count every legal vote. H.R. 1 is going to make it almost impossible to tell what we would consider a legal and proper vote for any precinct. I'll explain why in just a moment. It is also an incumbent protection plan. It will help incumbents and harm people who try to challenge them. And it infringes on our free speech and make the work for organizations like Tea Party Patriots Action and other 501c4s who want to have people notify people about what's happening with a piece of legislation and urge the people to pick up the phone and call their members of Congress. It puts all sorts of new rules and regulations on us.
So the kind of conversation that we're having right now could be affected by that kind of restriction should this law be enacted. I'm told by our friend Brigitte Gabrielle of Act for America that there's actually a provision, talk about incumbent protection, there's actually a provision in here that pays something like $600,000 to incumbents to campaign for re-election. Can that possibly be?
Yes, it does have that kind of provision in it. Now, that is, I believe, if you decide you're going to take the public financing, you don't necessarily have to take the public financing, but if you take
it's a pretty powerful incentive. Needless to say.
It is a powerful incentive, but what one of my advisors told me is that part of the reason they pick these kind of numbers is they go and look and say, okay, how much money did it take for the incumbent who got defeated? How much was the least amount of money raised to defeat that incumbent? And then they set the mark at that amount of money, so it takes at least that much to defeat an incumbent. And it makes it very appealing for a challenger. Oh, I could get $600,000 to run this campaign, and that seems like a lot of money, but the people in D.C. have figured out that if you spend that much, you're not going to be able to defeat us, more than likely.
Jenny Beth, you were actively involved in the effort to make sure that, as you put it, every legal vote counted in your native state of Georgia. Unfortunately, of course, that's not the brand that the left has been pursuing. They want every vote to count. Talk a little bit about what you saw happening in Georgia in this last election cycle, and for that matter, in the runoff that followed it for the two Senate seats, that would be essentially enshrined in H.R. 1, making the kind of crazy theft of an election that we witnessed in the last cycle permanent features of elections going forward?
Well, one thing that we had a lot of issues with is the absentee ballots. They were mailed out. An application for absentee ballots was mailed out statewide from our Secretary of State. They changed the rules and laws as pertain to absentee ballots. So you could sign a paper getting an absentee ballot in April, and that guaranteed that you, if you checked a certain box, that you would have an absentee ballot for every single election the rest of the election cycle, including the general election and the runoff. Normally, you had to request an absentee ballot within, I think it's around 60 days of the election. So if you'd requested one in April, you still would have had to request one again in roughly September to get one for the general election. Now, it is going to, and then they used drop boxes to drop your ballot in rather than going and putting it into a mailbox. And the drop boxes did not have a lot of security surrounding them, so you couldn't tell if there was ballot harvesting going on with them or not. Well,
these included drop boxes that were funded by Facebook owner
by Martin Zuckerberg,
placed only in Democratic precincts, as I understand it. Is that right?
Right. It was from the Center for Tech and Civic Life, and in Georgia, there were many counties who received funding from the Center for Tech and Civic Life, and 21% of the money went to Trump counties, 55% went to Biden counties, and 9 out of the 10 largest grants in Georgia went to Biden counties. So they used that funding to do drop boxes. Well, this bill in H.R. 1 will force the use of ballot drop boxes for absentee and early voting and have them available for at least 45 days before an election and during all hours of the day. That means you can't put the box inside of an office and secure it. It has to be outside where it's available all hours of the day. It forces the use of same-day registrations, and you can only have a signature to attest to the validity of a registration. You cannot use voter ID. You cannot even require ID when you go and vote in person. You can only have a signature attesting that the person is who they say they are. So even when you register to vote, you can't require like a utility bill to verify that they actually live where they say they're going to live. You can't require any other ID to verify they are the person they claim to be.
Let alone that they have the right to vote.
Right. And that's what I mean. It makes it impossible to tell if the person who is voting is legally allowed to vote in any given precinct. In Georgia, you are required by law to put the address of your home where you live, not a P.O. box, not a UPS store. It has to be the address where you live. And this is just going to have those kind of checks and balances that put safeguards on the system to verify that these are legitimate voters who are supposed to vote where they claim they are supposed to vote. It puts safeguards in the system. It's going to wipe those safeguards out, not just in Georgia, but nationwide. So many of the issues we had in Georgia will happen all over the country.
That's the point, and will happen forever if the Democrats have their way. Thank you for your leadership in calling attention to the problems with this legislation. Jenny Beth, how can people find out more about the problems with this bill and join the Tea Party Patriots in fighting it?
Go to teapartypatriots.org, teapartypatriots.org.
Wonderful. Jenny Beth, thank you. Come back to us with updates on this, if you will. It's great to talk with you, and thank you again for your leadership on this and so many other issues. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Lance Crayon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and I'm very excited to be able to introduce to you a man I've just met who has a very interesting story. Personal insights into one of the most dangerous aspects of the unrestricted warfare the Chinese Communist Party is waging against our country, and that is its information warfare, using a variety of instruments to inform, disinform, mislead, manipulate Americans, including a whole host of media operations, both overseas and here, and entities known as Confucius Institutes. And we're going to be speaking about both of these topics with Lance Crayon, a man who worked for some of these Chinese propaganda arms, as it happens, both in China and in the United States. He has come forward to talk about what he learned inside the belly of the beast and to raise a warning for us as to what is being done with these influence operations to the great detriment of our nation. Lance Crayon, it's good to have you with us. Thank you for stepping forward and telling your story. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. So tell us a little bit about your background, where you worked for whom and when.
Yes, okay. I arrived in Beijing. It was 2009 when Hu Jintao was president, and I a completely different China at that time, of course. I was hired to work for China Radio International, CRI, and I was an English news editor and videographer, and that's exactly how my journey began in working for Chinese state-run media.
And you went on to work for Global Times and China Daily, which are, you know, very powerful instruments of Chinese propaganda. As an English news editor, I guess, and reporter, as you say, videographer, you came back to the United States and continued working within the Chinese media for Global Times North America. What was your role in that job?
I was the senior news editor for Global Times, and we also launched the People's Daily English News app, and that was October 2017.
I think a lot of our listeners would wonder, what was a nice guy like you doing in outfits like that, and what prompted you to decide to, well, as they say in the world of espionage, come in from the cold, and to talk a bit about your experiences, and in particular, the really malevolent things that these propaganda organizations are doing here and elsewhere around the world.
When I worked for the organizations in Beijing, I wasn't entirely aware of the effect or impact or impression that was happening that they were having outside of China. And I also felt, as did I think a lot of my English-speaking colleagues from America and all over the world, that they just weren't taken seriously, because of the lack of credibility, the lack of facts, accuracy, so on and so forth.
It's like Pravda in the old days in the Soviet Union. Its literal translation was truth, and nobody thought there was any truth in it at all. But unfortunately, an awful lot of this is, as you've come to learn, taken, if not as gospel, as at least an authoritative rendering of the facts by the Chinese government, no?
Yes, yeah. Its influence is actually is taken much more seriously now than it was when I first started in 2010. And that's what's scary. That's what the Chinese, just your average Chinese citizen at that time, this probably hasn't changed. They knew not to take it seriously. They knew it wasn't real. They knew it was fake news, go down the list. So it was people who weren't Chinese, that were believing what they were being told by the government.
So Lance Crayon, tell us a little bit about what you've seen, particularly when you came back to the United States, about how the Chinese Communist Party is using these entities to really, well, as I said, misinform and manipulate foreign audiences like those in the United States.
It's really the Global Times. I would put that at the top of the list of all the propaganda arms, and specifically like the editorials. That's what you see quoted in the New York Times or in really most news organizations around the world. English speaking will quote what they read in the Global Times, specifically the editorials, because that is believed to be a reflection of Zhongnanhai, of Beijing, Beijing thought, more or less, in terms of...
Which is more or less Xi Jinping thought, is it not?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. 100%. And Xi Jinping has ramped up his involvement with People's Daily, which is the largest newspaper, the oldest newspaper in China. Global Times is a part of People's Daily, just under it, is connected to it. So he, his participation in... his participation with media and information has increased, I think, beginning really since 2015.
When you say increased, what does that really mean, Lance? Is that a more aggressive effort to have this kind of insidious, even subversive influence on Americans? How we not only see China, obviously, but also perhaps how we see the United States itself.
Increase his influence, global dominion is the word, is the expression I like to use. It's not just America, but certainly America is at number one on the list. You'll notice how Global Times is quoted by other news sources as well outside of America. But yes, it's his image. It is the image of China and China's progress, and China being the source of, well, I guess now, you know, well, at some point, information, where there more people will look at Global Times, will take that seriously as opposed to what they're reading here. And is that the end goal? It seems to be that's where it's going. If you look at some of the political leaders here in America, I mean, John Ossoff, he was retweeting and giving shout outs to Xinhua News Agency as early as 2012. Everyone knew I worked there in 2000, not Xinhua, but I was at Global Times, and everybody knew Xinhua was a joke, including the Chinese. And the fact that any political leader would take that seriously, any information that comes from certainly Xinhua, is laughable. And so that's what I noticed it as early as 2012.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this is no joke, because it does affect perceptions and perhaps even behavior on the part of countries as you say, political leaders, countries, or others in influential circles. And the Biden administration is at the moment chock-a-block with people who, I think it's fair to say, have been susceptible to these kinds of information and influence operations over the years, which makes this all the more serious. I don't know if you can speak to this. You, of course, lived in Beijing, and you, I'm sure, were aware of what was being done by the United States to have its information organizations like the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia used to try to share information inside China. How would you compare these two capabilities and the uses made of them by the respective governments, Lance?
Wow. I started working for state-run media before Xi Jinping was president, so it was a different China, like I said, with Hu Jintao, and during his last years in office, which China was much more open. There were more foreign reporters in China and working out of Beijing and across the country with much more freedoms. So I didn't, because I was new to China also at that time, I didn't really see, obviously, what I'm seeing now, because it is a completely different strategy, a completely different China, to be honest with you. So I didn't, the threat angle and the influence angle in terms of its detriment on the global stage is not something I really detected, because I was isolated in Beijing. And I was of the opinion, as I said earlier, that no one is taking it seriously.
But I'm asking actually a different question. I'm asking, how were the foreign broadcasts of the United States Information Agency, as it was called at the time, or these various outlets like Radio Free Asia, perceived by people like yourself or the average Chinese? Did you have a sense of that? I mean, let me ask it in a rather more direct way. One of the concerns that many of us have had about Voice of America, for example, under the Obama administration, particularly, and to a considerable degree, even under the Trump administration, was that it was bending over backwards to disseminate what was considered to be balanced information. That is to say, some of it straight reporting out of the United States or from U.S. government sources, but they would be weighting it, in a way, with Chinese information propaganda, I think it's fair to say. And there's obviously nothing like that going on in the Chinese state media, is there?
Right. I never listened to, and I didn't know anyone, Chinese, who listened to Voice of Asia or really anything. Radio Free Asia. The Chinese, the entire time I was there, didn't really go any near news, I think, from any country. It didn't come up in conversation ever. And there was never, hey, oh, today I read this and that. You know, a lot of media outlets, U.S. foreign media outlets, are blocked and you can't access on the internet in China unless you have a VPN. But it wasn't a priority. News and information, to gathering information at the news media level from any source, it just wasn't on the list of things to do day to day.
Lance Cran, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but there's a lot more to talk about. In fact, I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on the Biden administration's decision to permit a whole nother area of Chinese influence operations, the Confucius Institutes, to continue to propagandize in our country and otherwise conduct insidious influence operations. But that's for another day. Thank you for stepping up, for your courage in doing so, and for clarity that you're bringing to this very important part of what I consider to be the war for the free world. And we'll look forward to a further visit with you in the near future. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton, one of the leaders of the conservative movement in the United States, about his insights on what we're facing domestically as well as from foreign sources, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we are joined by a man I've come to know and regard both as a personal friend and as a much admired leader in the conservative movement. His name is William, better known as Bill Walton. He has been an enormously successful financier in the Wall Street world, who then turned to civic affairs in the Washington, D.C. area, working in a number of different capacities as a, well, freedom fighter, is the way I think of him, notably with a terrific podcast he calls The Bill Walton Show, and in his role as president of an organization known as the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a longtime member. Bill Walton, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to have you with us, sir.
Oh, Frank, delighted to be talking with you, although not particularly delighted about our subject matter.
Well, there's a lot of talk that we need to do, nonetheless, and I appreciate you doing it on this program, as well as the programs that I've been able to contribute to a bit, but you've been doing impressively on a host of issues now for several years with the Bill Walton Show, and I commend that to our listeners. Bill, I thought we might talk, and we'll have two segments with you, for which I'm very grateful. The first about the state of the nation, if I could. And you're a serious student of history. And I wanted to sort of draw on your study of history, as well as some of the comments about where we are, that Naomi Wolf, a prominent woman of the left, made last night on Tucker Carlson's program. And maybe we can come back to that in a moment. But let's set the stage for her assessment and yours of where we are at the moment by talking a little bit about what happens when, through democratic means or others, radical leftists manage to take control of polities like ours?
Well, yeah, Frank, you and I have been working together for years about, in the cause of freedom, really defending America, and America as a symbol of freedom against external enemies like Russia, radicalism, Islam, and the Chinese Communist Party. And what's becoming increasingly clear is that maybe the biggest enemies we have are not external, but internal. And we've got a growing cancel culture, a woke cancel culture. We've got the tech oligarchs who are part of that and shutting down speech on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, on and on and on. We seem to have the major corporations joining in on this. And you know, it's not what I would call a conspiracy, but it is, but they are making common cause. And it's common cause against people who believe in freedom, essentially. And, you know, what Naomi talked about the other night, she'd written a book, oh, I don't know, almost 15 years ago. It's called, what is her title here? But anyway, she lists 10 things that are evidence of a closing society in her book called The End of America, A Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. And, you know, the steps that we saw in Mussolini's Italy, Hitler's Germany, and then Lenin and Stalin's Russia, and there's a playbook. And if you look at where we've been going in the last decade, 10, 15, 20 years, it seems like we're following the steps of the playbook. And she now thinks we're at step 10, which is suspending the rule of law. And it's hard not to agree with that assessment when you think about what's happened with the COVID lockdowns and with social distancing, masks, shutting down businesses, shutting down schools, our right to assemble in a church to practice our faith. I'll end at that, but that's we're in a very bleak and real war to preserve freedom.
Yeah, I don't take any pleasure in describing this that way, and I know you don't either, Bill Walton, but it's hard to conclude otherwise, and it's vital that we be cognizant of it, not least because, as Naomi pointed out, the danger is that you see this playbook of the totalitarians at work, and one of its features is that people are cowed into silence or acquiescence until it's too late to resist. And she seems to think that we're approaching that point right now. And I have to say, as I look at the, you know, fortified green zone around the United States Capitol and other parts of Washington, D.C. these days, ostensibly because there is an enemy within, we're being told it's us, Bill, regular Americans who love this country.
Yeah, well, Frank, you and I are now domestic terrorists.
Well, I'm not going to acknowledge that, nor are you, but we are being called that.
No, I'm not, but
for sure.
But we're being called that, and you know, it's stunning how they've taken advantage of the events of January 6th to make all these extraordinary claims, A, about who was behind it, and B, about what the larger movement's about. And they're basically attributing what happened on the 6th to all 75 million people who voted for Donald Trump. And
certainly all of the half million or so people who were in Washington for his rally are being described as white insurrectionists or Christian nationalists or, these domestic terrorists. And by implication, you're right. It does seem as though they want to have it represent everybody else who voted for him.
You know, but where I'm seeing this is that, you know, if you believe in freedom as we do, and it's, you know, all the freedoms in the Constitution, assembly, speech, religion, faith, right to bear arms, petition the government, maybe even a right to be left alone. There are also something in there called freedom of the press, although that one's become pretty ironic because the press now seems to be in league with the state. And, you know, as an enemy, as defenders of freedom, and I think we all should be, and I think that's the most essential attribute, virtue, we are not even allowed to pursue the truth in trying to find out what happened. We don't know what happened January 6th at the Capitol. We don't really know what happened in the Georgia election. We don't really know what's happening or how lethal COVID-19 is. But what's happening is our ability to talk about it, to explore, to get into what really happened and what didn't happen. The debate you'd normally have in a free society has been shut down.
You know, it's interesting, Bill. A case in point occurred yesterday. Senator Ron Johnson read into the record of the hearings that were taking place with some of the former Capitol police officials about what took place on the 6th of January, an article that was written by one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, Dr. Michael Waller. And Mark Levin quoted from it again in his program last night. And this has been met with the most strenuous denunciations from outfits like CNN, which have said, you know, Ron Johnson was quoting discredited, debunked stuff about January 6th. And the truth of the matter is, Mike was there. He was an eyewitness to it. And he gave a good accounting of what he saw. And not nearly enough of that kind of information is being made available, to your point. And I was struck by something that Naomi Wolf said on Tucker's show that speaks to your point about the history here. She said, quote, "Autocratic tyrants at the state and now the national level are creating this kind of merger of corporate power, like, you know, Time Warner, for example, and CNN, and government power, which is really characteristic of totalitarian fascism in the 1920s. And, you know, again, we were told that the fascism was, you know, a creature of the right. I don't think that's accurate any more than Nazism was. These are all sort of socialist operations of the left. But the use of corporate entities, and you've spent a lot of time in, you know, senior positions dealing with corporate titans, you know firsthand the power that they wield. And when that is put at the service of the state, it is a formidable force for crushing freedom. And I think you're so right to warn about it. So, Bill, just to wrap this part of our conversation up, we're watching a whole host of legislative initiatives hurtling towards us under, this Democratic, you know, control of the Congress and the White House, and the fortified Capitol, it seems to me, being both a means of keeping constituents at bay, so they don't interfere with what their representatives, nominally representatives, are doing. And also, I think, to intimidate everybody else into the kind of submission that Naomi Wolf warns about. Can you talk a little bit about the thrust of this legislation? Because it does seem as though it's designed to strip us of our freedoms.
Well, the H.R. 1 essentially dismantles the election process, and I can't get into detail, but that's going to pass in the House. And whether it gets through the Senate, I don't know, but it's a dagger aimed at the heart of our ability to elect the next president. And so my biggest concern is that we may have seen the last fair and free election. There's a hearing today. I think it's in the House. I think it's Representatives Anna Eshow and Jerry McInerney, and they're going to be inquiring whether the media companies have done too much not to squash views on the right. And Alan Dershowitz wrote a piece today, and I saw it online. I don't know, basically saying this is they're calling people out in the same way McCarthy did in the Army McCarthy hearings. And so there's a McCarthyism going on now that's again that these people lack imagination. It is straight from the Communist Party playbook.
That's the thing that's so worrying. Yeah, it's not an accident, comrade. They're doing this with deliberation and knowing that it works. Bill, we have to talk about what we're going to talk about in just a moment, because we have to take a hard break. We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton, the president of the Council for National Policy, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Bill Walton, one of the leaders of the American conservative movement, both personally as a thought leader and as an institution leader, namely as the president of the Council for National Policy, a group of freedom fighters and patriots who are committed, as he is, to our constitutional republic and who recognize that it is under extreme threat at the moment from, as Bill says, enemies foreign and domestic. Bill, you were talking a little bit about the challenge that this poses to us, this domestic effort to essentially strip us of our freedoms. And I had to interrupt you for the hard break, but pick up that thought if you would.
Well, I bring up the hearings in the Capitol only to draw attention to there is, you know, things like McCarthy hearings before. And You know, Sarah, my wife and I drive back and forth in her house in Virginia and in D.C., and we read Modern Times. And Modern Times by Paul Johnson gets into very interesting stories about what happened with Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler. And there's a playbook. And we read this, and it's just exactly speaking to us today. And, you know, I'm essentially an optimist. I think we can prevail, but I think we can only prevail if we understand what's really going on. And what's really going on is not the typical American Democrat versus Republican politics. And we're simply a centrist society and maybe center right, and we're going to prevail. What's going on is much deeper than that. And when you have corporations, particularly the major tech companies, when you have all the major institutions, the K-12, universities, media, Hollywood, aligned, and everybody increasingly agreeing that there's only one view, one viewpoint, or whatever, one narrative that they'll allow, that's a big problem. And so I think for your listeners, and it's important that we understand that this is not Adlai Stevenson versus Dwight Eisenhower. This is something much more, much more dangerous. And I think if we recognize
by that you mean politics as usual. This is political warfare. I would argue of a increasingly aggressive and perhaps incipiently violent kind.
And we haven't talked about our favorite topic, Frank, which is the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party is delighted with the results of this election. And as I say, I'm not going to claim to know the truth about anything, but it certainly looks like the Biden family has got some ties that make them compromise. Whether that's true or not, I certainly know that they're not going to pursue the aggressive line of action that Donald Trump is pursuing.
And I think it's also important to note that the Chinese made very clear their determination to see the defeat of Donald Trump and the election of Joe Biden, and they have accomplished that. And it may be by crook as well as hook. But the point is that we find ourselves today, Bill, in an increasingly perilous situation where freedom really is imperiled and the forces arrayed against it, foreign for sure and internal to our country, are formidable and increasingly, it seems, succeeding in, putting all of us in jeopardy of a sort of totalitarian outcome. So the question occurs, what do you, as a thought leader and a leader of an important part of the conservative movement, say needs to be done at a moment? What can people who feel as we do, and as Naomi Wolf on the left does, and she makes an important point, which I really was very heartened to hear her say, if I can just quote her one more time, Bill. She says, this is not a partisan thing. That transcends everything that you and I might disagree or agree on. That should bring together left and right to protect our Constitution. So how do we do that in these circumstances, Bill? And is there hope that we will rise to the challenge?
Well, I think that we've got, as I mentioned, the word common cause. There's a common cause of, I think, the anti-freedom forces at work. I think we need to think about it the same way. And I couldn't have been more delighted and surprised to see. And I read the transcript and I looked at it and I read her, took a look at her book. I mean, she's right on point. And if, as a woman from the left, the traditional left, seeing this, I think is heartening, because I still think I don't have a particular line of action. I think the first thing we need to do is we need to get people to wake up. Now, I've been extremely disappointed in Americans' willingness to let themselves get locked down. Of course, it's not only America, it's at the Anglosphere. I mean, look what's happening in Australia, New Zealand, UK. I mean, UK has just increased its fines to some extraordinary number. There's pictures of police bobbies going into apartments or flats in London and rousting people out because there are too many people at a party. I mean, it's really I think what we need to do is we need to keep getting the messages out as best we can. And I don't know how many your shows you've had pulled from YouTube or demonetized by YouTube, or you know, now when I do a show on COVID-19, they'll put a warning over it. The only official language that anybody can speak about COVID is from the CDC. And of course, we know the CDC is utterly unreliable. So I don't have a specific line of action, except we got to recognize that the traditional social media companies, it's going to be more pervasive. It's not going to get better in the near term. It's going to get worse. And we will need to find alternative ways to communicate. I'm encouraged that Parler's coming back up. I hope they've got the servers to support a robust platform. And it may mean we need to find other ways to communicate. You know, it may be, I don't know, it might be the mail. It may be fax machines.
You know, what a lot of us have come to is a conclusion, Bill, and I think you're sort of leading that direction too, is we need a sort of conservative ecosystem whereby people can communicate, yes, and do business with people who, you know, may be boycotted by the left, but are nonetheless patriots and are, you know, supporting freedom. And otherwise, you know, enable these kinds of vital conversations to occur and proliferate, so that even people who don't think of themselves as conservatives, but who love this country, who are whatever political stripe, some of them are Scoop Jackson Democrats, perhaps like I used to be. Some of them are independents. Some are being called progressive patriots. Whatever, you know, rubric they might be politically, they nonetheless share this commitment to our freedoms and to the Constitution that guarantees them. And I think this argument you're making for common cause is so vital. And it starts with, yes, understanding the threat, but also being able to make that common cause, which goes to freedom of assembly. It goes to, you know, freedom of, well, worship, among other things. And I know you feel as strongly as I do that the threats to all of those are the sort of thing that has to be denounced and addressed.
I've got one immediate line of action. I think if I could pick one topic, and I have like 32 number one topics, but my number one topic is election integrity. You know, what we saw at the presidential election, the left had done an awful lot of work to make the local laws friendly to what they wanted to have happen, whether it's signature validation or how they handled the mail-in ballots and so on and so forth. But somebody said to me, well, they stole the election, but they stole it fair and square. And they did it because they changed a lot of the rules that were very favorable to their side. And I think traditionally conservatives had not been willing to put the work into poll watching, election integrity, state and local election laws, precinct captains, stuff like that. It's the nitty gritty of a functioning democracy. And I think unless we do that, we could have 2/3 of the country on our side and still not win elections.
Be disenfranchised completely. Yes.
That would be, we can't let that happen.
We can't. And Bill, I just want to get down to brass tacks on this, because I started the show with our friend Jenny Beth Martin. We're finishing it with you. And I think the point that has been made by both of you, and we've been making relentlessly, as I know you have, is this is coming down to brass tacks with this bill H.R. 1, which will be taken up by the Congress in the next few weeks, I believe. And at the moment, the Democrats have majorities that will enact it. And if that happens, as you said earlier, Bill, it may well be that we've seen our last free and fair election in this country. We will be permanently disenfranchised. And I just want to emphasize to our listeners, small numbers of Democrats who decide not to go down that road will make all the difference. There are a number of them, 46 or 7, I think, that are said to be vulnerable in this next election cycle. If you're one of their constituents, especially, but all of us really need to be letting them know they must not go down this road, because it will perhaps be, as you say, the number one agenda item for the left to deny us our free elections, and it must be our number one priority to assure we have them going forward. Bill Walton, thank you for your time today. I hope you will be a frequent visitor here. It's great to talk with you, as always, and congratulations again on the work you do in that regard at The Bill Walton Show. I hope everybody will check it out. And then come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.